All right, this morning we'll be picking up on page 91 with May It Never Be or God Forbid, but unfortunately we have to go back a little bit because there's no point in talking about why something can't be without remembering what it is that can't be. So, you know, it's always interesting at the end of the football year when you have a losing season. Was it the coach's fault or was it the player's fault? And sometimes you don't know, right? As a matter of fact, I think we kept a play, we kept a coach a couple of years, right? Because we couldn't figure out whether it was the players or the coach. as we look at the effects of God working with mankind, would you say that God's been numerically successful in converting the vast majority of the human race?
Nope.
No, he has not. Would you say that God's Jewish people were, that the law that they were given and that the information that God and God working with them, did it seem to help at all?
Some yes, others no.
Well, it, you see the point. It's kind of the same question, isn't it? Is it the player's fault? Is it God's fault? Well, in this case, though, what do we know?
The players are God's
fault. It's never God's fault. And that's what Paul is asking here. Does the fact that the Jewish people were constantly becoming unfaithful, does it mean the law is too hard? Does it mean that God was too harsh? Does it mean that God was not loving enough or kind enough or working hard enough? And Paul said, does their unfaithfulness negate the faithfulness of God? And of course, that's when he makes his point, may it never be. And this is a unfortunate translation, as I mentioned last week, because the word God is not in here and the word forbid is not in here. But I think what they were trying to do is they were trying to find an appropriate English idiom to express this Greek idiom. Now, what's an idiom? We've talked about this a lot through the years. Virgil?
I would look at it in the old saying.
Okay. It's a saying that doesn't mean what it means, right? Like a piece of cake. Or he missed the boat. Did he miss the boat? No, there's no boat.
Probably not.
He didn't miss it. It was an opportunity. He missed an opportunity. So, God forbid, unfortunately, with the term God forbid, what does it come very close to doing?
Taking
God's name in vain. I've never really been happy with people using God forbid or God this or God that, because a lot of times it just turns into using God's name in a wrong way. So, literally, the word is the verb of being. Not being is literally what he says here. Not being, except he puts it into a grammatical construction that we can't really reproduce. Let me read something. I didn't put it in your books, obviously. I pulled this out last night. But let me just read you a little bit about the ending on this word. The optative is the mood of strong contingency, the mood of possibility. It contains no definite anticipation of realization, but merely presents something as conceivable. Hence, it is one step further from reality. So, what Paul does is he picks the most unlikely way to express something, and then he says, may it not even be that. So, this kind of has the idea of, may it never even possibly enter your mind that this could ever come to be. And it's a very powerful expression, but we don't have any way to convey it. When the New American Standard has, may it never be, or perish the thought, it just doesn't really capture the idea of, this is something that could never really happen. And then in front of that, it's negated. So the translators went ahead. I think I looked it up yesterday. It's used about 11 times in the New Testament in the Old King James, the Old American Standard. The newer translations have gotten away from it. But again, unfortunately, they can't really, because it would really be better to say, may it never, ever, even possibly ever become thinkable that it could ever be. That's kind of how the Greek construction would put it. And so this is something, don't even let it enter your mind. There's no way that God could be unfaithful. Now, you remember that passage in Hebrews 6? I think, yeah, I do have it on the... Now, Brian tells me that some of you have it on page 93 and some have it on 91. How many have...
93 is the second time he says, may it never be.
Oh.
So that's is 91 at the top.
Okay, everybody, 91?
Yep.
All right. So on the middle, toward the middle of page 91, Hebrews 6, 17 through 18, God interposed with what? Okay, two immutable things. What are the two immutable things? And don't say it's impossible for God to lie, because that's not one of them. There's two immutable things in which it's impossible for God to lie.
He swore an oath.
Okay, that's one. And what do we call what God gave to Abraham?
Covenant.
The law and the...
Covenant.
Well, covenant, but...
Promise.
The promise. Okay, so when you're... telling your children, tomorrow we're going to go do this. And they say, do you promise, what are they after?
Confirmation, yeah.
Okay, that's stronger than a word, right? A promise is stronger than just a statement. And if you don't do it, and they say, but you promised. What does that mean? Well, a promise is a powerful thing. But not only was there a promise, but there was also an oath in God's name. And as Paul pointed out in Galatians, when men want to swear, that's the end of all dispute. So when God swore, and then he makes his application, which is that we might have strong encouragement. It is not possible for God to become unfaithful. I will never leave you. I will never fail you. I will never leave you in a situation where you cannot handle the situation. So... and then he makes the statement that I've always appreciated, and that is, let God be found true and every man a liar. So when you look at that, have people questioned God in the past?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Book of Job come to mind?
Yeah.
And how does God end the book of Job? Who is this who darkens counsel? With words without knowledge. And then he says, will you condemn me that you may be justified? And this is a problem. We all run into it from time to time. Even if you say something like, why did you make me like this? What are you saying?
It's your fault.
Yeah, this is all your fault. God, and that can never be. Virgil?
Isn't that somewhat of an old debater's stance also? A straw man. You take and build up the straw man and cut it down to make yourself look good.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We don't want to take full responsibility for what we have done, so we find someone else to blame. A lot of battles between husbands and wives follow along the same line, don't they? It's all your fault. Or you bear some responsibility in this, when the reality is they don't at all. Charles?
Yeah, also, you know, well, God summed it up there with Job did too, when he asked Job the question, where were you?
Yeah.
When I did what I did.
Exactly.
You know? So, you know, I mean, that lets us know also too, where were we? You know, we're right. Someone that just came along, you know, and so God is your fault, you know, so.
Well, it's an easy thing to do, and a lot of people do it. Brian?
Yeah, and like Ezekiel 18 and verse 1, you know, the Jews in general, where they you know, made a saying, you know, our fathers eat grapes and our teeth are set on edge.
Right.
In other words, it's their sin. They weren't taking responsibility, and God called them out on that. He's like, no, first off, this will never be said again because it's a false statement.
Right.
You kind of get the impression here they were doing the same thing. They were making these statements.
Yeah.
And God's saying, no, that's...
Yeah, and that's exactly right. Paul is dealing here. It's going to get real interesting as we go into this class, because Paul is dealing with some specific charges that they were making in that generation. And so, again, as always when you're studying the Scriptures, you're looking over the shoulders of the people who actually received the letter and then making applications to today. So in this particular case, these are arguments that the Jews are making. If you're going to say... that we are not God's chosen people, then you're reflecting on God. And so Paul is saying, no, I'm not. I'm reflecting on you. You are the ones who failed to take advantage of the opportunities. And so let God be true. Whenever there's any question on anything, who's going to be right and who's going to be wrong? God's always going to be right. We're the new kids on the block, right? Who's been here forever? God. Whose lifestyle then will be the standard that we're going to use? God's lifestyle. God's way of thinking. And not because he's stronger. I mean, my dad used to say that. I don't know if you ever heard that, but you do as I say, not as I do. And that doesn't sit well. But when you're this tall and he's this tall, what are you going to do about it? So you're just going to kind of seethe inwardly, but you're not going to be able to do anything about it, but you're going to be thinking, you just wait. But with God, that's never the case. It's not because he's bigger than we are. It's because he is absolutely in the right. As a matter of fact, how many times does it say it's impossible for God to lie in the Bible? So let God be true. Whenever there's a question, whenever there's a doubt, just keep one thing in mind. The scriptures are always going to be right, and man's always going to be wrong. And if there's ever a question, we're always going to come back to that. Then he has a quote from the Old Testament, and that you may be justified in your words and might prevail when you come into judgment. Now, this quotation is from Psalm 51, and many years ago, I did a lot of research on Psalms 51 because most people want to attribute that psalm to David. But unfortunately, there is not a single shred of evidence anywhere in the New Testament or the Old Testament to attribute it to him. It certainly applies to him because of his sin, but it may or may not have actually been written by him. So we need to be careful. But this was spoken by a sinner. Let's just use David because David could be the type here. So David waited 9 months. Well, maybe not a full 9 months, but Nathan came just before the baby was to be born. So it'd been quite a while. And he spoke with David, and David finally did what? He repented, he acknowledged his sins, and then he made the statement here that we see at the bottom of page 91, and that is that sinners are always going to be the liar. Now, when we get into a situation where we decide we're going to sin, sometimes we're very convinced that what we're doing is just fine. We've made all these rationalizations, we're ready to go to before God and explain to God. A lot of people are doing this today. They're getting involved in situations that are questionable. They're getting involved in activities that are really not proper or actually are condemned by the scriptures. But they're going to go before God, and what are they going to be able to do?
And nothing.
Well, no. I mean, in their mind, what are they going to be able to do?
I'm
going to justify myself. I'm going to show that in this particular case, there should be an exception here. But what all sinners need to understand is that God is the one who is going to end up being right. He's the one who's going to be justified. He's going to be the one to be righteous. Matter of fact, how many times did he say in the Old Testament that these laws are righteous? And what does the word righteous mean?
Just.
Fair, just, equitable, honorable. So if I find one of God's laws is not fair and just and equitable, then what's the problem? Let God be true and every man a liar. And so that would make a good motto to have in any debate that you're having, is we're looking for the truth of what God has revealed. And so God is going to be justified in his words, and God is going to prevail when he comes into judgment. And so, when's the best time to repent of your sin? In front of God when it's too late, or now?
No.
See, God's right. And really, when you think about it, what is a confession?
Agreeing with God.
It's an acknowledgement that
God was right
and I was wrong. So, that's really what a confession is. When God asks for a confession, the word Greek word for confession, homologeo, means to speak the same thing, or to agree with, to admit to the fact that God was right all along. So that's really what he's after here from the Jews, is you need to acknowledge that you're the ones that are in the wrong, that it's not God who is in the wrong, but this is what's in their way. Remember the context. Where we're heading here is that you are all in sin and you need to obey the gospel. And so these are arguments, or these are proofs that Paul is putting forth here to try to show the Jews the necessity of their repentance. They're not going to be able, they've all got these arguments in their mind that they're going to bring before God on the judgment day. And Paul is showing here, they're not going to work. You have to obey the gospel. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and there's only one way to be saved, and that's to obey the gospel. And so he's slowly dismantling their walls of protection. And in the process, dismantling our walls of protection as well. Because most of us, I think we've talked about this a lot lately, and that is that everybody else's sin is so terrible, but what about mine? I really aren't so bad, and I really don't even know why God has those things in the Bible as being wrong. Because I, you know, honestly, I don't really see anything wrong with them. Anybody think like that? You hear people talk like that sometimes? There's really nothing wrong with what I'm doing. I mean, isn't that what the homosexuals are telling us right now, and the adulterers and the drunkards and the immoral people? There's really nothing wrong with what I'm doing. But God is going to be true. Every man's a liar. And Jesus, I think, remember at the end of his life in John 12:48, he said, "He that rejects me and does not receive my words has one that judges him. The words that I spoke shall judge him in the last day." So we have the New Testament. We already have that information. All right. Now, in verse 5, we have a new argument. A new point that they're bringing, and that is, our unrighteousness commends the righteousness of God. Now, this is a really difficult concept, and as I say in the first paragraph, the question is not nearly as difficult to understand as the specific act of unrighteousness being considered and the motivation of asking it. Let me just read through this a little bit. If the theme of the section is being maintained, then there is a question designed to put the Jew under sin and take away all his excuses. From Paul's words in chapter 3, 7, and 8, it is also evident that he is speaking to those who know the terrible accusations that have been leveled against Paul and the bitter attitude in which he is held by the Jews. So what we're looking at here is, why are the Jews saying, "My unrighteousness commends the righteousness of God"? Now, let's talk a little bit about this word "command," and then we can tie this together. The word "command" is used twice in the book of Romans. It's used in chapter 16 for Phoebe. Matter of fact, the whole reason for this book being written is to commend Phoebe to the Roman church as being what? A faithful Christian, right? Faithful, godly Christian. So the idea of commending, this is also the word used in Romans chapter 5 when Paul said that the death of Jesus on the cross commends God's righteousness to us. In other words, it reveals it to us, it shows us its depth, it shows us its power. So how would the Jews' unrighteousness commend or prove God's righteousness? And you're scratching your head, and I'm scratching my head, and then you're realizing, okay, what is Paul actually saying here? What the Jews are actually saying is that the more unrighteous we are, the greater it shows God's righteousness to be. For example, I'm a 90-pound weakling, and here's a guy over here who can lift 300 pounds. So I walk up to the weights, I can't even move it, and he walks, and does my weakness commend his strength? Does my weakness show how much stronger he is than me? And it's impressive. Now, a lot of times people at home say, "Well, I could do that if I was there." But if it's clear that you can't do it, and in this particular case, my unrighteousness proves how great it is for God to be righteous. So the more unrighteous I am, what does that show God to be? So the more unrighteous I become, then the more righteous that makes God. Therefore, shouldn't God be thanking me for being so unrighteous? Now, does that argument make any sense to you? But that's what they're saying, okay? That's what they're saying. And you're thinking, you're scratching your head, and you're thinking, how could anybody? But, you know, the same thing is true today. When you hear somebody say, "God only condemns homosexuality that's not monogamous." If you have a monogamous homosexual relationship, then that's okay. Now, does that sound like a very great reason? Does that sway you. Oh, I didn't know that. That now I know it's okay. No, it's the same thing. But so the people who make the argument, they think it's a powerful argument, and the people who are hearing the argument doesn't make any sense to them at all. So if our unrighteousness commends the righteousness of God, what shall we say? In other words, if the greater the blackness of our sin, the whiter God looks. So God should be so happy with us. Jeff?
So isn't this very similar to what Paul says in chapter 6? Shall we continue to sin that God's grace may abound? You know, the more we sin, the more it shows God's forgiveness.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
It will be the same.
You know, glory to God. Let's keep on sinning. Let's sin even worse.
That's and again, it takes a certain perverted mindset to think like that. And fortunately, because we've been educated in the scriptures for so long, this argumentation makes no sense at all. Matter of fact, the first time, it took me a long time to get through this section because I'm just looking at this thinking, how in the world could people think like this? But again, would it be in the scriptures if people didn't think like that? This is an argument. This is a major argument. And again, I think that there's a lot of people, even today, who look at it like that. I mean, you think about John Calvin looking at God and saying, back in eternity, God chose just a tiny, small amount of people to be saved. The rest of them he just cast into hell. If unconditional election would be true, wouldn't you think there'd be more people who would be serving God? It doesn't make any sense. So Paul is emphasizing that when others fail, those who succeed look good. Therefore, what conclusion should we draw? Well, and that's why on the bottom of, or in the middle of page 93, he asks the question, is God unrighteous who visits with wrath? In other words, it's not fair for God to punish if our unrighteousness makes God look better. And then he goes on to say in the next verse, let me grab it real quick and then we'll come back to this. He says, why don't we sin that grace may abound? Why don't we just sin more and more and more? Let us do evil so that good may come. And that's not going to be the case. So the question Paul asks is God unrighteous? From the beginning in the garden, did God thank Adam and Eve for sinning because it showed him how righteous he was? No, he cursed the world. And when the flood came, did God say, wow, these people are showing me to be so good in my character? No, he punished them. And so what he's saying is, your argument is totally illogical, totally and completely illogical. Because God has visited with wrath all along, does that make God unfair? And of course, the answer is no, it doesn't make him unfair. The fact is, this argument is false. Our unrighteousness does not commend the righteousness of God. It's exactly the opposite. Our unrighteousness reveals that we are wicked and evil, and it doesn't reflect on God's righteousness in any positive way at all. It reflects on us, not on him. So, again, as Brian said at the bottom of page 23, we have, may it never be, may it never possibly ever even enter your mind that this could ever even possibly be. And because if that were the case, how could God judge the world? We're just adding in a concept that would just convolute everything. And so it's one of those things, you just have to crush it and say, it's not even worth thinking about, it's not even worth talking about this. So, let me read you this paragraph on the top of page 94. A lawyer could attempt to clear the client accused of murder by using the same type of reasoning. As we enter the courtroom, he's giving his final words to the judge and jury. My client is definitely guilty. He did murder that child. But before we condemn him to death, let's examine all the good that came from his act. He proved our police force to be of the highest caliber because they caught him. He proved that the laws of our land are good in condemning such act. He has shown that the nation is outstanding in its ability to offer a fair trial to those accused of wrongdoing. He has given you an opportunity to sit on a jury and watch the criminal justice system work. He has certainly accomplished many good things as a result of his crime. It is my contention that since so many good things have come from his act, he should go unpunished. Now, does that sound good? But that's the argumentation here. You're thinking, you know, you're trying to wrap your mind around it. You're like, the person who would argue like this is crazy. But and that's why I put this illustration in here, just so we can see how insane this argumentation is. But yeah, you can, when you do evil, can some good come? Yeah, I mean, there are good things that can come from evil. The situation ethics, right? If I lie about the Nazis are knocking on the door and I got all these Jews in the basement, do you have any Jews here? Can I do good if I do evil?
Yeah.
Can I do evil if I do good? So now what? Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, you have to do what's right. Regardless of the consequences, you have to do what's right. All right. Verse 7 then, but if the truth of God through my lie abounded to his glory, why am I still judged a sinner? So now Paul introduces himself into this, because these Jews are making this argument, and he says, you know, if you're right, then I'm glorifying God more than all of you, because you think I'm the chief of sinners. So shouldn't you be commending me? Shouldn't you, if the truth of God through my lie abounded to his glory, why am I still judged a sinner? So this is the, first of all, this is a clear example of the kind of reviling that the apostles were going through. In other words, the truth of God through my lie. So what are these Jews calling the gospel? Paul's lie. This is Paul's lie. Now, doesn't that make sense that they would say Paul made this up? Where else did it come from? Apostles made it up. Remember Peter in chapter 1 there? We did not follow cunningly devised fables. Well, clearly, that's another example of the kind of reviling and the kind of slander. You know, we often look at the apostles and we think, well, they could perform miracles and they could raise from the dead, so they obviously were believed. But the sad reality is, as we see here, that that's not the case at all. That the fact is that Paul was viewed as the one who created the gospel, and it was Paul's lie. But he says, if the truth of God through my lie abounded to his glory. What's the truth of God? Well, the truth of God is what he just revealed. The truth of God is that the more I sin, the better God looks. And since the more I sin, the better God looks, that's why he's showing this grace. And this grace is going to get us to heaven. So the more we sin, and as Jeff pointed out, let us do sin so that grace can abound. Same basic thinking here. And Paul is just crushing it. It is all false. The grace of God does not mean that sin is not sin or that God is happy with sin. The grace of God only means that God is merciful and compassionate, but he hates sin just as much as he ever did. The sad reality is that through our repentance and our confession, God has simply said, I'll take the blood of Christ and I'll wash away your sin. But does that mean God's going to be happy with any sin that we ever commit? And the answer is absolutely not. The truth of God did not abound to his glory through Paul's lie. The whole reasoning is false. Paul is trying to crush it. Paul is trying to convert as many people as possible. And sometimes, unfortunately, when you have to go in to study with these people and you have to deal with their arguments, you end up looking foolish yourself trying to reason with them. And so here Paul is making some statements, and here we are 2,000 years later, and we're looking at this, and we're trying to figure out, what in the world? Why would anybody say that my unrighteousness makes God's righteousness look good? How could anybody think like that? Well, but they were, and so he's dealing with it. So verse 7, the same thing. You're calling the gospel my lie. Well, by your line of reasoning, that would mean that it was abounding further to his glory, and therefore, why are you judging me as a sinner? And why not, verse 8, if your reasoning is true, why not, as we are slanderously reported? And some affirm that we say, let us do evil that good may come. All right, so here's another reviling. Here's another argumentation that was being made in the first century against. I mean, do we have revilings today? Do people say negative things about members of the Church of Christ? That we're legalists? That we think that you can't use God's grace at all? There is no grace to the member of the Church of Christ. You have to do everything just exactly right. Is that what we teach? But does what we teach sound like that? Yeah, it definitely sounds like that. Because when you're looking at Nadab and Abihu, where's the grace? Well, there's grace of God, but what happens when they willfully sin? And so the same thing is true here. These arguments are made. Now, slander is reported, and some affirm that we say. So, first of all, Paul makes it clear. And again, remember, the Holy Spirit is guiding Paul as he's writing these things. So these are not his own personal observations, but these, I'm sure they were very hurtful. And I'm sure as he's writing these things, it must have been very painful for him to be thinking about it. We are slanderously reported. Now, what does the word slander mean?
Speaking to the fame,
reputation. Okay, slander is saying something that's not true. Saying something evil about somebody that is not true. Matter of fact, the word devil is the slanderer. The one who... Ray?
False accusation.
Yeah, it's a false accusation.
The devil is an accuser of people.
Exactly. So it's false. So when Paul says slanderous, he's saying right then, did I ever say that? Never said that. But we are slanderously reported, and some are affirming that we say. Now, remember when Paul comes to Rome and he goes before the Jews and the Jews say, we've heard about this sect, it has spoken evil everywhere, but we'd like to hear what you have to say about it. Well, Paul hasn't come to Rome yet. Remember, he wrote in the first chapter, I'd like to come and help you, I'd like to establish you, lay my hands on you, and allow you to be able to have spiritual gifts. So Paul is sending this information to them. And of course, we're looking over their shoulders and we're seeing what Paul was dealing with at that time. And then, of course, we're going to make our own applications. Now, none of these arguments are really being made today. I think maybe this chapter laid them to rest. But anyway, verse 8, why not, as we are slanderously reported and some affirm that we say, let us do evil that good may come. So this is the argumentation. Now, let me read this first paragraph underneath that. If that isn't enough to drive home the folly of the above reasoning, then take it to its final conclusion. Stretch it as far as it will go, right up to its very limit. If one affirms that the more wicked and sinful one is, the more glory and honor is given to God, then why not just sin all the time? Why not just go out and see how much sin you can accumulate so you could really honor Him? Now, if I preach a sermon like that, what's going to happen?
Probably be removed.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I hope so. I mean, that kind of reasoning is ridiculous. But that's the argumentation that's being put forth. Now, at the bottom of page, let's see, I better catch up with my notes here. I'm reading off of my other notes. Top of page 95. The word, I think I made this point a couple of weeks ago in one of my sermons. When we say the word blasphemy, what do we think of?
Blasphemy of the Holy Spirit of the Lord. Or
okay.
God.
So if I say something bad about Rob, is that blasphemy?
Technically, yeah.
Technically, but we wouldn't. Would you go away, Alan blasphemed Rob today? Do we talk like that?
No.
But that's the Greek word, as you see at the top here, page 95. Blasphemeo is to speak reproachfully, rail at, revile, to speak things essentially that are not true. And people who do that, their condemnation is just. So when God condemns this action, it will be just. And can you see that it's just? Can you see that this argumentation is so stupid, so senseless, so empty of any reason? When we condemn it, is that just? And so that's what Paul excuse me, that's what Paul is emphasizing here. All right. Any question up to verse 8? Rob?
Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil. Verses like that come to mind that just the world just views things totally different. You mentioned last week about homosexuality. There's another church, I can't remember what it was, this week. Mormons, maybe? I don't remember. I'd have to look it up. But they came out, and now they're accepting homosexuals in that lifestyle, and they're and all that into their religion.
Wow, if that's the Mormons, that's going to be a
I'll have to look. Yeah, it was.
Well, the Pope's getting close, isn't he? I mean, as you listen to the Pope, you're starting to see they're hedging a little bit. Now, whether if they cave, we're going to be in big trouble because there's just there's not going to be anybody to hide behind anymore. Okay. So now we are going to draw our final conclusions in verse 9. And can somebody go back and give them a hand? Thanks. Got somebody coming in a wheelchair. So, verse 9 now, we're going to finally start summarizing the final section of the chapter. And are we better than they? Now, who's the they?
Gentiles.
The ones putting forth this argument.
What's that?
The ones putting forth this argument.
Okay, could be. Are we better than they? Well, we know in chapter 1, who was he talking about? Okay, those who, first generation apostates, the Gentiles. And then in chapter 2, he's talking to people who condemn them, but are not a part of God's people. Now, are we better than they? So, who are we talking to now? Good morning.
The Jews.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. So, we are the Jews, and they are everyone else. All right, and everyone else is called Gentiles. So, are we better than the Gentiles? So, we're in Romans chapter 3. I think I have a book up here, Charles. Let me see here real quick. No, let's go to 1 John. So summing everything up, we saw starting in chapter 1, I'm sorry, chapter 3, verse 1, that the Jews had been given tremendous advantages. But did they end up any better than the Gentiles? And the answer is, in no wise. Absolutely not. In no way, whatever. So now verse, the bottom there in verse 9, on page 95, we laid to the charge both of Jews and Greeks that they are what? There's all under sin. So, again, as I mentioned when we started the book of Romans, the first three chapters are designed to prove that everyone needs to obey the gospel, because without the gospel, everyone is a sinner, and the wages of sin is death. So we have now reached the concluding section of the first chapter, or the first section, and that is that all of sin falls short of the glory of God. The Gentiles sin, now the Jews sin. We have laid to the charge both of Jews and Greeks that they are all under sin. And then he starts quoting scripture. He just starts quoting the various scriptures that prove his point here. So we begin with, there is none righteous, no, not one. Now, where's that verse found? See there on the top of page 96?
Psalms 14.
All right, that's Psalms 14. And that begins with, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good. Jehovah looks down from heaven upon the children of man to see if there were any that did understand and that did seek after God. And what does he say in verse 3?
All gone aside.
They've all gone aside. Now, this was written long after the law was given to the Jews. So the Jews, the law did not change the state of the Jewish people. They were all, they've all gone aside. They are all become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. You remember Isaiah? I read that word filthy. You remember that passage in Isaiah? All our righteousness is as
filthy rags.
And so even the Jews could recognize that with the law, and Paul made this point in Galatians, the only thing the Old Testament law was able to accomplish was to give people the knowledge of what?
Sin.
The knowledge of sin. In other words, the more laws you write, the more sinful we become. And it's fascinating how that works, because as we study the Scriptures, even now, as we study the Scriptures, do you still find things from time to time where you said, oh my, I never saw that before. Here's another one I got to start working on. And that's just the way life is. And Paul says that this is an upward call. And as we master one set of sins, when we first become a Christian, we get rid of all the blatant stuff, the lying, the cheating, the smoking, the drinking, the filthy language, the vile conduct. That usually goes away very quickly. And so by the end of 2 or 3 years, we're not really, those things aren't really even in the scope anymore. So now we're sinless, right? No, what happened?
Top layer.
Well, we found out that not only can you not commit adultery, but you can't look at a woman to lust after her. And not only can you not murder, but you have to never be angry with people. And now, what's happened to the standards? They're just getting more and more and more meticulous. And as we get deeper into the Scriptures, we find that even now, I think most Christians, I've never met one that wouldn't say this, that without the gospel, all my righteousness would just be filthy rags. Anybody here disagree with that statement? Anybody say, no, I've reached it. I'm glad you didn't raise your hand. We'd have to rebuke you, right? All right, so because that's God's verdict. Romans 14 is God's verdict, and that is they are all corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good. And I think that he's going to continue quoting. I mean, if you look at verses 11 and 12, this is continuation of Romans 14. And what does he say at the very end of the section? Who, when the law is writing, who's it writing to?
Those under the law.
So this is not written to the Gentiles. This is written to the Jewish people. All right, so we'll go ahead and stop there. And we'll pick up in verse 11 next week and just kind of quickly finish up this section. As you can see, there's not a whole lot left to this particular section. So we're going to be hitting and spending a lot of time then in this next section, which is Romans chapter 3, verses 21 through 31. So I would appreciate, there's a lot of technical terms. So if you could take a little bit of time this week and just go over the Greek definitions and some of the points that are made from page 100 to, we probably won't get that far, let's say 100 to 106. Just kind of look over those things, and that way we can move a little more quickly through this section. All right. Thanks a lot, everybody.